Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Eric Banks, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Wright State University. His new book, The Realistic Empiricism of Mach, James, and Russell, Neutral Monism Reconceived, is just out from Cambridge University Press. The Austrian physicist Ernst Mach, the American psychologist William James, and the British philosopher Bertrand Russell shared an interest in understanding and explaining the mind in naturalistic terms as a phenomena that is not metaphysically distinct from the body, as Descartes argued. This basic commitment to materialism is the received view of mind today, but there remain many disputes about how exactly such phenomena as consciousness and thought can be understood in materialist terms. An underlying metaphysical question is how to interpret the material in materialism. The view, which Mach, James, and Russell all defended, is the idea that the material is neutral, that it is neither mental nor physical, but is instead manifested in ways that we would classify as physical or mental. In this innovative critical history, Banks presents the neutral monist movement as a whole for the first time, elaborating the contributions of each thinker to the overall view, which he calls realistic empiricism, and of which neutral monism is a critical part. He also extends and defends the view in two very important ways. He shows its validity and vibrancy as a contender in contemporary metaphysics of mind, and he also outlines some of the mathematical structural framework of the underlying neutral metaphysics. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Eric Banks. Are you there?
Yeah, hi, Carrie.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to talk about your new book today, The Realistic Empiricism of Mach, James, and Russell, which presents and defends what's often thought of as the neutral monist position, using Russell's label for it. It's a position that he has, as you argue in the book, that he was thought to have held for a short time and then abandoned. You show that that's not true, but you also kind of put it in the context of both Mach and Ernst Mach and William James, and present them as a movement. Right, these three figures from three different fields, physics, psychology, and philosophy, all combined in one book, presenting a position that you think is, ought to be a contender today for the metaphysics of mind. So let's just, to start off the interview, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into philosophy, and how you came to write this particular book.
Okay. I don't know how far back we want to go. Today, I'm a professor out at Wright State University in Dayton. And my interest is broadly described as history and philosophy of science. And I really sort of do mean those two things to go together. Sometimes that field is called HPS, for short. How I got into philosophy. I mean, I was one of those kind of science kids. I think it was maybe logic that kind of grabbed me. And I went to an undergraduate institution where I could pretty much study what I wanted. And I kind of just jumped into analytic philosophy, Quine and Davidson and Kant and all sorts of things. And then I sort of got interested in philosophy of science again, which is, where it all began for me. And Mach was that figure. So I won't go into the gory details, but when I was in graduate school at CUNY, I sort of returned to Mach after many years. And I only really knew Mach's Mechanics, which is a great book if you know some physics and you want to get into the classical mechanics, the deeper details. Mach is a great place to start with that. So I wrote my dissertation and my first book about Mach, and it was called Ernst Mach's World Elements, A Study in Natural Philosophy, and it appeared from Kluwer in 2003. And there was a chapter in that book about other neutral monists. So there was I think it was chapter 9 of the first book, which had a section on James and Russell. I was aware that this movement existed, you know, for about 10 years, and it all sort of came together where I decided, well, no one had really written about this movement as one whole thing. So I knew that I could write a book about that. And then I realized that as I got more and more into this position, and this is what often happens in philosophy. I mean, you start out pretty neutral, no pun intended, and then you kind of you get into the position and you realize, hey, this is rather interesting. You know, maybe this can be pushed further. So, as you correctly said, the book has this kind of hybrid. I'm talking about the new book now. Mm. Has this kind of hybrid nature. I mean, it has these historical chapters in the early going, where because this is not a well-known movement in analytic philosophy, I felt that the whole thing had to be explained from scratch. And I couldn't really take my first book for granted in people's minds because not that many people read it. So,
well, Ernst Mach is a you know, acquired taste, I think, for some
very
people.
Tough. Yeah, very, very tough to read. And maybe we can talk about that later. But the Mach was a scientist after all. So if you want to read Mach, you have to go back and look at all of these scientific controversies he was involved in. As a historian and philosopher of science, I love that stuff, you know. But a contemporary analytic philosopher might have a lot of difficulty reading Mach today. So anyway, the book has this kind of hybrid nature. It has this historical movement that is center stage, and then I would say the real subject of the book is realistic empiricism itself as a philosophical position. So once you do this kind of skullduggery and you unearth this, this position from the history of philosophy, then the next question is, do you want to take this further? And I decided that the answer to that was yes. I wanted to see what could be done in philosophy of mind and what could be done in philosophy of science with the position. And so the last two chapters are really my own. I gather from some of the people who've read it that as you phrased it, the philosophy of mind stuff is going to be more interesting to philosophers today, because neutral monism is talked about. It's not a popular position by any means in the metaphysics of mind, but it is something that comes up and people do know about it. So, if that's how people want to read the book, that's fine with me. I also think the last chapter on the philosophy of science and the metaphysics of event particulars is something I put a lot of work into myself, but that may not be as popular a topic.
Okay. So you've used the term, two labels there. One is that there's a movement here. And another, you introduced the term realistic empiricism, whereas, you know, I knew neutral monism is the label, let's just put it, that most people will be familiar with. If they know anything at all, it's under that label. So let me kind of combine into one question. Why are these three figures, what binds them together essentially as a movement, which can go under the name of either realistic empiricism or neutral monism? And if you have a preference for one of those labels, why would you prefer it?
Okay, let me take the last question first, because I think it's the easiest one to answer. I see neutral monism for me is a sort of subset of realistic empiricism. Realistic empiricism is what I call the overall position. Neutral monism is actually a term that was coined by Russell. It was coined by Russell in a set of articles he wrote for the Monist, the publication, in which he started out as a skeptic of the position. So it has this history. The term was not used by Mach, and it was not used by James. Mach's term for his position was something really awful, like imperial criticism. James, a little better, radical empiricism. What does that mean? Who knows? I really decided I was not going to get caught up in this thicket of labels. The neutral monist position I'll talk about in just a minute. So what I wanted to say is the realistic empiricist movement is, in my mind, a kind of broadening of the classical kind of British empiricism of Locke, Berkeley, and Hume into a realistic position. So the idea is that Mach broadened the idea of a sensation as a you know, mental or a subjective occurrence into a kind of objective part of physical inquiry, a real physical event. And this kind of kicked off this movement towards broadening what was an empiricist view into a realistic view of mind and nature, hyphens all the way through, mind and nature. And what James added to that was the epistemic part, a sort of direct realist theory of perception. And what Russell added to that was a theory of what he called the event particulars, where there is in his two books, in much of his writing of this period, maybe 1913 to 1927, there's this use of a kind of general manifold of event particulars and their causal relations to each other that encompasses both the phenomena of mind and the phenomena of physics under this general kind of event ontology and this kind of manifold conception. So the three kind of developments, I'm calling all of that realistic empiricism. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to leave the neutral monism to describe this kind of narrower view of what do you do with mental events if you're a physicalist or naturalist philosopher. Well, this is the quote unquote neutral monist answer to that. So let me take the other question. So why is this a movement? Well, for one thing, that's a historically accurate way to describe these three philosophers. Mach had an enormous influence on James and Russell directly. That can be documented. I'm not going to bore you with all the details of that, but Mach and James were friends. They met in Prague and had this long, like, five-hour discussion about psychology and metaphysics and everything under the sun. And Russell, there is actually a passage in Russell's analysis of matter where he says that he considers himself to belong to a neutral monist movement inaugurated by Mach himself. So if it's good enough for Russell, it's good enough for me. So on the historical side, I feel very strongly that's established by the, by the facts. Now, the conceptual similarities are more interesting because there are obviously commonalities and there are also differences among these three philosophers. I mean, each one an incredibly independent thinker. So some of the similarities, they all have this view, although they call these things different things, like Mach calls them the elements, James calls them pure experiences, Russell calls them event particulars. But they all believe that the proper naturalistic view, the proper view of nature, is a view of events. And maybe Russell's word is the best, particular events, particular happenings of some sort. You know, they are concrete, they really exist, but they're not like objects. They kind of come and go. So all three philosophers hold some variant of that basic view of what there is. And then they also have this view that those event particulars are bound together with real relations, real causal functional relations. And this is something that's really not known so well, that Mach has the view that the relations are just as real as the elements are themselves. This is not David Hume warmed over, in other words. These are this is something that has to be taken, as part of the metaphysics of the view. James actually says you're not a radical empiricist unless you believe in the reality of relations. along with the reality of the pure experiences that are related by those relations. So James calls that a kind of concatenated view of what exists. And then Russell, who's often thought to be a kind of empiricist philosopher in his later days, also has this view that the event particulars are bound together in perspectives, kind of like causal laws or laws of optics or projections of how these effects interact with one another in a kind of mesh. So that's another detail that I found in common. There are still others. I mean, we can go into some of them in more, later, but they all deny the fundamental, ego, as one might say. They have a view that the ego or consciousness, and maybe I'll use those words, interchangeably, that there is such a thing as a kind of functional aggregate of all the different sort of functional relations that we call mental, memory, association, those sorts of things. But that the idea that the ego is somehow fundamental, this view that you get from Brentano and phenomenology and, very much still a part of analytic philosophy's historical set of concepts. Mm-hmm. None of these philosophers take the ego to be fundamental. So that's a big, big difference with philosophers of mine today. So I'll leave the rest for later. But those are some of the historical and conceptual commonalities that that make me very confident that these three guys belong to this movement together.
Okay, so the first of our trio then is Mach, who is a fascinating figure, and you've done a lot of your prior work has been focused on him in particular. So let's start with his contribution to the overall view, which you characterized just a little while ago in terms of sensation. His view of sensations as an objective part of physics. So he uses the term elements, and you say these are all, for all of them, they're events, and I want to get to that concept of an event later on. But just to begin with some of the details of, the first two chapters, what is Mach's view of these sensation elements and the element function that sort of brings them all together? How does this work? I mean, he's providing kind of the first element, no pun intended, of the overall view. Okay, so how tell us about that?
Okay, this is the thing that Russell thought where Russell thought Mach had made the essential breakthrough that kicked all of this off, and I'm just going to read the quote from the Analysis of Sensations because it's so good. So here's Mach speaking about the neutrality of the elements. He says, a color is a physical object as soon as we consider its dependence, for instance, upon its luminous source, upon other colors, upon temperature, upon spaces, and so forth. When we consider, however, its dependence upon the retina, it is a psychological object, a sensation. Not the subject matter, but the direction of our investigation is different in the two domains. It is only in their functional dependence that the elements are sensations. In another functional relation, they are at the same time physical objects. So this is the idea that when you talk about the difference between let's use the example of a color. When you talk about the difference between the event of seeing blue as a sensation and as what Mach calls a physical event, what he says you're doing is you're taking the same neutral particular, the event of seeing blue, full stop, no qualification, and you're saying, well, if I'm talking about certain kinds of relations like, is this the same blue I saw yesterday? Or does this blue lead to a yellow after image? Other sorts of what he calls psychological or psychical relations. you're talking about a certain set of functions that the blue belongs to that connects it to other elements that we call the mental relations. But if you talk about the other physical events that can be connected with the blue, like the wavelength of the light or the condition of the retina, the brain, the cellular basis for seeing the blue, this same neutral particular belongs to that row of functional relations as well. So the particulars themselves have no particular allegiance to being classed as mental sensations with those types of functional relations to other particulars, or as physical events with those types of relations to other particulars. And that's what's really meant by the idea that sensations are neutral, that they shouldn't be automatically classed in the slot of the mental and permanently segregated from physical events. So it's very bold in one sense. He just says, I'm not going to do that. Now, then the next question that you want to ask is, well, you know, we don't often think of these sensory qualities as physical. I mean, we think of them, yeah, they go on in the brain somehow or other, but they're not really part of the physical world because, I don't know, I mean, are they made of atoms? Do they, you know, interact, you know, clearly with other sorts of physical events? So the idea is that Mach is saying, yes, they are physical in any sense of physical you want to use, simply by switching them over and concentrating on those variations. But I think in a broadened sense of the physical. So this is very curious where, and Russell uses this language too, where you say, wait, are you saying that there are these two completely separate orders and it doesn't matter which order you put it into, but the ordering remains separate? Or are you saying that there's some sense of the physical or natural in which all of the elements and functional relations would someday be included within one area of study? And I strongly believe that the second reading is the correct one, that if we stop and say, well, these two orders are these two kind of dualistic orders, the particular stuff is neutral, but the orderings are separate. I think then we end up with another kind of dualism, and that really isn't very interesting. But sorry, go ahead.
I was just trying to think of a Davidsonian position. I mean, you had mentioned reading Davidson in your own personal history.
A long time.
The Davidsonian position of anomalous monism, not neutral monism.
Yeah.
Is the idea that whatever, you know, if you let's adopt the event particular language, which he's actually fine with, and just say, well, you have mental events and you have physical events, or more precisely, you have physical events which can come under mental descriptions or physical descriptions.
Right.
So, but to clarify, how does your neutral monism, how does Mach's view, you know, differ from that?
Yeah, the anomalous monism, it's the anomalous part that doesn't fit with the classical neutral monism. The idea is we're making progress towards a unified scientific view in which there would be no distinction between the physical variations and the mental variations, that they would belong to one sort of unified fabric. And these would remain as kind of separate, provisionally separate departments of inquiry, but they wouldn't represent hard and fast distinctions between objects or between even conceptual distinctions, you know, between things. So this broadened sense of the physical that is used by Russell very often is, I think, the real way in which neutral monism is to be taken. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that this often happens when I explain the view. People say, well, I get the idea, you know, that this stuff is neutral, but if every sensation is a physical object, is every physical object a sensation? Because it's sort of, you know, it sounds like you could just flip that around. And the answer really is no. And the reason is because there are elements that are not sensations, and all of them talk about it. Russell called them unsensed sensibilia. James sometimes talks about these sort of elements of physical work as opposed to elements of mental work. So he has this idea that force and energy are somehow involved here. And Mach also, and this was really the subject of my first book because this was not known about Mach, that Mach also has the idea that we have to fill out our sensations with other unobserved elements that sort of complete these functions within experience to further objects that may include unobserved elements outside of our direct experience. Now, that's not a view that people know that Mach held. And it's important because I think realistic empiricism does carry that idea that these neutral things are not just sensations. They also, that sense of the physical has to be taken in a very full-blooded way. I just want to read you another passage because the position is almost never received that way in the history of philosophy, and that this goes all the way back to the beginning. Of all people, Vladimir Lenin, the famous revolutionary, wrote a book about Mach and the movement that he inaugurated all the way back in the early 20th century. And this was his view of Mach's elements. I'll just read a little bit of this. Lenin says, Mach and Avenarius secretly smuggle in materialism by means of the word element, which supposedly frees their theory of the one-sidedness of subjective idealism, supposedly permits the assumption that the mental is dependent on the retina, nerves, and so forth, and the assumption that the physical is independent of the human organism. In fact, of course, the trick with the word element is a wretched sophistry, for a materialist who reads Mach and Avenarius will immediately ask, what are the elements? Either the element is a sensation, as all empirio-criticists, Mach, Avenarius, Petzold, etc. maintain, in which case your philosophy, gentlemen, is idealism, vainly seeking to hide the nakedness of its solipsism under the cloak of a more objective terminology, or the element is not a sensation, in which case absolutely no thought whatever is attached to the new term. It is merely an empty bauble. So that reading, I mean, this is a terrible, travesty of the kind of subtle position. And of course, Russell wasn't fooled because he read Mach, I think, the appropriate way, as did James. But most people, I think, read it the way Lenin read it, that, elements are sensations. This is just Hume all over again. And we don't really need to worry about this. You know, this isn't a serious philosophy. So that's a terrible shame.
Well, let me just press for 1 minute the not so much that reading, which, you know, does seem not fair, but just the idea that you have these event particulars, which we need to go into more, that when they are in certain what you call causal functional relations, are sensations, and when they are not. And so it's true and pretty obvious, I should think, that not everything is a sensation, not every event particular is a sensation, simply because not every event particular will be in the right causal functional relationships that are required for it to be manifested as a sensation.
Correct.
But of course, that means that, you know, any event particular could in theory be a sensation were it in the right nexus. Let's put it that way.
All right. I think that's going a little too far.
Okay.
I think there, you know, to take an extreme example, Russell uses the star Sirius, and he says, what I mean by the existence of the star Sirius is all of these causal interactions that the star has, not only with observers on Earth and with human brains through the light that reaches the Earth, but through other objects, by streaming radiation and energy out into space itself, and all of these things sum total are what I mean by the event particulars that make up the star Sirius, all of its interactions. And it's just obvious that some of these interactions, like in the middle of the star somewhere, will never be human sensations. Just by physical fact.
Okay, but no, they couldn't be human. But I think the worry that Lenin and perhaps other people, even if they aren't sensations now, there is the possibility. And I'm not saying that this is a terrible thing. I'm just saying that it seems to follow that if that event in the middle of Sirius were in the right causal functional relations, it would be a sensation. It would not be a human sensation, but it could be a, I don't know, universe sensation or Milky Way sensation or something to that effect, right?
Well, at this point, we get into another debate, whether neutral monism collapses into some kind of panpsychism. And
right, this, which was something I wanted to raise later, so maybe we should just talk about that now.
Maybe we should, because...
or we can put it off, but it's up to you.
Now, whenever somebody says, let's have the talk, I always say, no, let's have the talk now. I think that's a very anthropocentric view of the universe that that I don't think realistic empiricism or neutral monism lead us to adopt. In fact, I say a lot about that later in the chapter on philosophy of mind, where I deliberately separate the view from any form of panpsychism. There's no similarity between the elements in the heart of a star and what goes on in these complex events in human brains, except insofar as anything might be similar to anything. I mean, it's so empty as to just say, well, these things, this exists and this exists. And beyond that, there's no reason to call the event in the center of the star a sensation of the universe. That just doesn't say anything. I will say one thing that I have some sympathy with your view, because I do see the view as an empiricist position. And the argument goes as follows. Would you believe in an element that occurred without any possible kind of extrapolative causal relationship with the sorts of elements in our experience? So, for example, in regards to Ernst Mach, this question came up in the subject of whether one believed in atoms at the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century. And Mach had a very bizarre view of atoms. He thought of them as little kind of Kantian Dinge an sich, where there could be no causal interaction with these things. And almost no one believed that, by the way, you know, at the time. But what Mach is saying as an empiricist is, yes, there are elements that cannot come into the ambit of my experience and become sensations, but they are causally connected with my sensations. Everything that I want to believe in as an empiricist has some kind of causal relationship, however extrapolative that might be. However lengthy that or convoluted that causal chain might be, as long as continuity with experience is established, Mach is pretty much on board with that. Now, it's up to you as a scientist. You have to track down that connection and try to make as much of nature accessible to experience as you possibly can. And Mach's own work as a scientist exhibits this abundantly. So in that sense, I agree with you. The connection with experience is absolutely vital. But this idea of making everything an experience of some subject, whether that subject be the universe or the galaxy, is just way crazy. You know,
that's well, just. I guess I was more thinking that the notion of sensation itself is not a anthropocentric notion. At least it ought not to be, given given what else Mach says, or the neutral monist, the notion of sensation itself should be generalized and shouldn't just be thought of as the way humans experience things.
Well, that's a bridge too far, I think, for this position. I think the label, we may be arguing about labels at this point, whether you want to call them sensations or elements. I mean, I prefer the neutral terminology of element, and the sensation just seems to carry too much baggage.
Okay.
But there are other reasons, which I think we should talk about later, why neutral monism probably shouldn't be lumped together with many of the panpsychist views.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's turn to James.
Yeah.
So that chapter was that's where you present his direct realist bit, anti-representational realism in some way. So could you explain his contribution to the view?
Yeah, I was not originally many aspects of writing this book were unintentional. I just kind of followed the argument, you know, where it led. And one place it led was to James and his very interesting theory of perception. This is just a fascinating, you know, story. James has this personal, you know, friendship with Mach. He reads Mach's books. They're very, very strongly connected through professional psychology, something what used to be called psychophysics, still is in some quarters,
right.
Where, Mach and James both made fundamental, you know, discoveries. And at a certain point in the 1890s, James starts to, you know, James is kind of like a planet on a really eccentric orbit, like that kind of, you know, he started orbiting philosophy again. So he realizes that what Mach has said about neutral elements could be applied to a theory of knowledge in the following way. Suppose that a neutral particular can be classed both as, like the blue again, could be classed both as my sensation and as a part of a real mind external physical object. Well, James says, then my knowing of the blue, my knowing of the object that is blue is not representative but immediate, in the sense that the, you know, the piece of it, the neutral particular that is both sensation and physical element, is directly perceived by me without intermediary. And this is very important for James because he's setting himself against what you might call representative theories of perception and knowledge. And this is the usual kind of, you know, 17th century theory that there's the external object that has all these primary qualities, doesn't have any secondary qualities, interacts with the brain in some way or other, produces this image. And then the image kind of stands in for the object via this either causal or just sort of representative relation. And James sees that neutral monism can be used as a, you know, as a way to break the hold of that position. He then goes on, and what's interesting about James is he has this passage. It's very famous. It has to do with I've never actually been to Memorial Hall, but it's supposedly, you know, Memorial Hall at Harvard, which is sort of out the door and down the path somewhere from James's office. And he talks about what makes the representation of Memorial Hall into a real perception of that object. What would count as, you know, is it the mental image? Well, I might have a mental image and then I get to the hall, I find out, wait, it doesn't have a triangular roof. It has a square roof and, you know, the windows are all in the wrong places. And then you have to revise your initial assumption that the image had any representative powers at all. So we're now talking about something different. This is about not just the immediate perception of sensations and neutral stuff as both a part of the knower's mind and the known object. We're talking about extending that outward towards what makes mental representations, or what makes – I shouldn't even use that word – what makes for the perception of an object. And James's answer is really interesting. It's a, you know, it's a causal theory of knowledge. And he has this great passage where he's talking about tigers in India. Mm. This is really famous, but I'm going to read it anyway because I like it so much. He's talking here about Brentano and the idea of intentionality. Do our thoughts or perceptions intentionally refer to objects? In other words, are they the contents, you know, of those acts? And so he says, when you think about tigers in India, he says, so I'll just quote here from James. The paper is called The Knowing of Things Together from 1894. He says, most men would answer that what we mean by knowing the tigers is having them, however absent in body, become in some way present to our thought, so that our knowledge of them is known as presence of our thought to them. A great mystery is usually made of this peculiar presence and absence. And the scholastic philosophy, which is only common sense grown pedantic, would explain it as a peculiar kind of existence called intentional inexistence of the tigers in our mind. Now, James ridicules this, so he goes on by saying, the pointing of our thought to the tigers is known simply and solely as a procession of mental associates and motor consequences that follow on the thought and would lead harmoniously, if followed out, into some ideal or real context, or even into the immediate presence of the tigers. It is known as our rejection of a jaguar if that beast were shown to us as a tiger, as assent to a genuine tiger if so shown. In all of this, there is no self-transcendency in our mental images taken by themselves. They are one physical fact, the tigers are another, and their pointing to the tigers is a perfectly commonsensical physical relation. I hope you may agree with me now that in representative knowledge there is no special inner mystery, but only an outer chain of physical or mental intermediaries connecting thought and thing. So what he's saying is we've mistaken these real causal relationships between particulars that we happen to experience and the other particulars that we don't experience making up the object, but causally connected to the object. And we've interpreted this via some medieval scholastic woo-woo as a real phenomenon of intentionality, where all it really represents is the incompleteness of our subjective mental, you know, representations, perceptions, and the broadening of those perceptions into the genuine perception of an object. So what the chapter is about is, well, how do you do that? How do you broaden these sensations into perception? What makes a sensation into a perception? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the argumentation is a little dense here, but I'll try to condense it by saying that it is only in this broadened sense. So sensations taken by themselves are just these kinds of blobs and squiggles. I mean, they are real and they're even physical, cum mental, if you like, the neutral monist language, but they're not perceptions of anything beyond themselves. They have no inner intentionality. They're just events. They occur. In order to broaden those happenings, those sensations into the genuine perception of an object, you have to make a judgment. You almost have to make a kind of intellectual judgment that these sensations are embedded in a broader kind of perspectival network. So, for example, when you look at the room, this is another one of James's famous examples. You look around the room, you see the books and the chairs and all of this other stuff. And James says that you can directly perceive that you are in a room, because if you're not, then these chairs and tables are only just blobs and squiggles. They'll still be there in the sense that, you know, the daubs of paint on a canvas make up a kind of a, you know, a flat pattern. But they won't actually be the perception of an object unless, unbeknownst to me, but maybe known later, that these sensations were embedded in these kind of perspectival relations such that the chairs actually have a back, which I can't see. That, you know.
So let me just ask a question at this point for clarification, as usual. The sensation, and maybe we can, you know, the theories of disjunctivism in philosophy of perception.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So is this a disjunctivist view?
I think not. We'd have to have a long argument about what disjunctivism really means. The way I understand that is, here I am in the room. I don't know, obviously, whether I'm hallucinating or not, but I can assert a disjunction. Either I'm just having these sensations of a room and not really in a room, or should it turn out later that I am really in a room with objects, then I knock out the mistaken disjunct and I get to assert that I'm in a room with objects.
So at any moment of time, I mean, this is it's interesting because, and I know you have this this discussion about kind of when. So there's sensations which don't have this intentional relation, and by sensation, we're talking about including thoughts and things like that.
Yeah, blobs and squiggles.
Well, you know, thoughts about tigers in India, and then I can have those thoughts, and there's no stimulus, obviously, in front of me of tigers in India. So there's no kind of causal relationship there. But I can still have these. Well, this is sort of the question.
Yeah, that's the question. And yeah. I'm not going to agree with you there because
okay.
I think you can have the mental accompaniments of thoughts.
Okay,
I mean,
right.
I mean, one of these, I've actually had this dream. I don't know if other people listening have, but you have the dream that you're speaking a foreign language and you're getting away with it. You know, people are understanding you. And you think to yourself, you realize in the dream, you know, wait a second, my French isn't this good. You know, how am I getting away with this? And you realize maybe when you wake up that, wow, I mean, those syllables didn't mean anything in French. That was, you know, that was completely, I was fooled by thinking I was forming French sentences. And really I was just forming these syllables and, you know, getting away with the experience of thinking I speak French. And I think that's what the mental accompaniments of thoughts become on this view, that unless your thoughts are really and truly connectable with something, the way that the image of Memorial Hall, instead of just a swirl of colors, really has to be connected with the hall to be about the hall in any sense of aboutness. You get it. Okay, let's go.
Well, I think I do. So let me just so the idea is let me put it this way and clarify what I'm saying that's wrong. A lot of the debate here is, you know, in the Brentano terms that you mentioned, is about this, you know, hocus pocus of intentional existence. I mean, in their terms, right? And that has been a big puzzle. It is, you know, often thought of as the puzzle.
Yes, it is.
At least intentionality, that aspect of philosophy of mind.
I'm not going to interrupt you, but if I just might say for a minute, when I open a book on philosophy of mind, it's almost always about that.
Yeah.
It's how do thoughts have content?
Correct. As I understand it, basically what's being said here is that whole debate is based on an erroneous premise. And the erroneous premise is that when we're having these so-called thoughts about tigers in India, we're actually having a thought with that, what we call this mental content. That's a mistake. We're really not thinking about we're not really thinking about tigers in India unless I've got a tiger in front of me and I'm in India. Otherwise, no. I am undergoing a state which we incorrectly characterize with the same content description, but that's actually not quite correct. I mean, strictly speaking, it's not correct.
Only if you're wrong. If you're right, you still get to be right. It's just that when the proper connection is made, and James doesn't even think you have to go to India to make this connection, that as long as there's a reasonable causal chain, here again is that idea that the extrapolative causal relationships, you know, establish these connections, you'll be right. Your mental thought about the tiger in India is a thought about a tiger in India, if there's a tiger in India. But if...
I'm causally connected to it.
Yeah, but if it turns out not, then your thought was never about anything. It was simply the mental accompaniments of blobs and squiggles. And it's really the whole phenomenon of intentionality for James and for Mach. And this is coming not very long after Brentano writes his book, A Psychology from an Empirical Standpoint. So this is, you know, they're criticizing him right in the, you know, and as a contemporary.
Right.
So the idea is that when you're right, these mental accompaniments become connected with the mind external object, and the mental representations become embedded in the perspectival structure of a room or of the world of objects out there. And then in reverse, that is what gave them their sense of reaching out to objects in your experience. But if it should turn out later that this is some kind of a hallucination, then they never had that phenomenology to begin with.
Right. And we're mistaken in our introspective access.
Correct. But you can also be right, in which case they have all of those features that you said they have. And James is one of the strongest defenders of that. He says when you're really in a room, you can feel, you can reach out to these objects in this room. And you are absolutely right to do so.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's what's kind of cool about this position.
It is cool, but let me just raise one problem, and then we probably want to get a little bit about Russell.
Sure.
So you're sitting in a room. You're not in any way causally connected to tigers in India.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking some sort of deductive syllogism about tigers in India. And you're going through all these thought processes. If there are tigers in India, then there are tigers. There are tigers in India, therefore. And now that looks to be a perfectly fine example, you know, particular instance of a syllogism.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems on this view that, you know, if I'm not causally connected to tigers in India, you know, whether I know it now or not, or that I haven't really done anything. I haven't engaged in any real deductive logic because all that's been going on in my head have been a bunch of what you call just squiggles and what have you. But, you know, there's just been lots of event particulars there that don't add up to propositional thoughts.
Well, there's two things going on here. I mean, obviously, logical inference could be about anything. So you can have all kinds of elaborate deductive structures and inferences about objects that don't exist.
Right. Okay. But still.
When you say propositions, you start, you know, that then we're kind of in Russellian territory. I mean, what are these propositions? And does the concept proposition mean something outside of logic? Like, does that really connote the idea that thoughts have propositional content no matter what, whether you know these objects to exist or not? And I think the answer to that is no. But when you're in the situation of just being confronted with your blobs and squiggles as events, I see no reason why you can't reason like this blob and squiggle is to the left of this blob and squiggle, which is to the left of this blob and squiggle. Mm-hmm. Therefore, blob and squiggle 3 is to the left of the left of blob and squiggle 1. That's a perfectly valid inference, and it's about something in the sense that very minimal sense.
Yeah, but it's not what I thought it was about.
Right.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
I know we have to go on, but I just wanted to say that one of the helpful metaphors I have here is what I think James properly reconstructed is saying is that sensations belong to the moment. You know, you can have a sensation of a room and it can turn out to be a kind of breakaway movie set where, you know, behind the walls is nothing and they've just kind of fooled you. The people in the windows are just these paper cutouts and stuff like that. Those are the kinds of things that sensations represent. But perception has this intellectual component, which means that if a perception really is a perception, it belongs to a series of perspectives in space consisting of other objects, such as, you know, the chair really has a back. It's not just a picture of a chair. And perspectives in time, I think, is the other important thing, that a judgment implicitly makes a kind of jump to this idea that in the future, I'll look back upon the judgment I'm making now and know that it wasn't just a sensation of blobs and squiggles. And I think that's the confusing aspect of the view, that once it's taken on board, it becomes much, much less confusing. That you might say, like, a slice through a three-dimensional object is not a three-dimensional object. It's just a slice. And if you're saying that this slice is a slice through a sphere or something like that, you're saying that it's more than just a circle. It's part of a series, you know, of circles that make up the sphere. And that's what I mean by judging that this is my this circular slice is a perception of an object, most of which I don't immediately see. So I'm going to leave it there. Okay. Hey, read the book.
Yeah.
Curious about this.
Right. So let's, I mean, we're starting to get a bit tight on time, and I do want to make sure we get to Russell.
Right on.
So let me just, you know, the way you present Russell is as being sort of the most conflicted figure of the three regarding the position. He never gave up, as you put, a representational view of knowledge, and this sort of left a cleft between him and then Mach and James on the other hand. So can you, you know, just briefly tell us about his conversion to neutral monism, and then, you know, why it was never pure, why it was problematic for him in a way that it was not for James and Mach?
Yeah. Okay. Just to reiterate, the James Mach view is a view I call in the book a view of knowledge and error, that these things like sensations either agree or don't agree with external objects. This is a causal relation. The same relations that lead to knowledge will also lead sometimes to error. As James says, sometimes you're led to a jaguar and not a tiger. So this anti-representational theory of knowledge is what they really and what I consider part of the orthodox realistic empiricism view. Russell is not like this at all. Russell begins as a skeptic of neutral monism. He almost always accepted the idea of the neutral sensation. He says it as early as 1912 when he talks about his sense data, before he's even given up the idea that there are sense data. He says that the sense datum is neither physical nor mental. It is, you know, it's neutral. And he's taken that part of the view on board and always did. When he goes to formulate his theory of knowledge in 1913, 1914, he's hooked on this theory of acquaintance, which is a Brentano-esque view, that you must make some allowance for the idea that particulars, when perceived by a mind, come into a special relation of acquaintance to that mind, and that all other acts are knowledge, belief, based upon this basic notion of acquaintance. Now, in 1919, Russell gives that view up after this very, very lengthy battle with Wittgenstein and, you know, with himself, where he finds out that a theory of knowledge like that is just not going to work. So in the wreckage of this theory of knowledge project, he decides to go back and say, well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe there's something to neutral monism after all. And he writes this article in 1919 called Propositions on What They Are and How They Mean. And you could already see in the title that he hasn't quite given up on the idea that knowledge is some kind of relation of belief in a proposition that can then relate to a fact, true or false. And so this is not the way that the other two think of knowledge. That knowledge and error proceed along exactly the same causal paths. There's nothing except the termination of that path to determine which one you're on. And Russell has this idea of knowledge that, no, there has to be kind of an intermediary thing. He thinks it's made up of mental images by 1919, that there's a belief in a certain kind of concatenation of mental images, and then these images have some sort of relation of truth and falsity to facts. Russell's what we would call today a correspondence theorist. And what Russell says is really interesting. He's now James and Mach have no trouble with false belief. False belief is just non-agreement. It's just when you get to India and you find out, whoops, we were supposed to go on the Tiger tour and we're in some other country and we're on the Jaguar tour. Well, that's not good. So I guess, you know, I guess we were wrong about where we were headed. Russell is saying that now it doesn't sound so bad that, you know, the correspondence of propositions with facts until you start thinking about false beliefs. So what is it when you believe falsely? Well, if let's say P is a proposition that, you know, that turns out to be true and you know, properly correlated and all that. What is it to believe in not P? Well, it's belief in the fact that things are not that way. But there is no such fact. So what would that concatenation of mental images, like in the novel 1984, when Winston Smith believes whatever it is that 2 + 2 = 5, you know, mm-hmm. What is it that he believes falsely that 2 + 2 = 5? But there is no there's no possibility that you could believe that because there's no possibility that things could be like that. So Russell has this, and this is still after the neutral monist conversion. I'm just going to read this funny passage because it's this is from the philosophy of logical atomism. Russell says, you will notice that whenever one gets to really close quarters with the theory of error, that's the puzzle of how to deal with error without assuming the existence of the non-existent. I mean that every theory of error sooner or later wrecks itself by assuming the existence of the non-existent. Now, you know, that's a dyed-in-the-wool correspondence theory that even has correspondences for false facts. And I think that's just not neutral monist in any sense of the word. Mm-hmm. And I think Mach and James are way ahead here in the sense that they already see a kind of causal theory of knowledge taking place, although they do much less to articulate it. I must say, even when Russell decides he's wrong, it's only because he's worked out in excruciating detail the problems with the wrong position, something that I can't really say of Mach and James all the time. Mm-hmm. But in defense of Russell, he's the third man in the triumvirate here who really builds the event particular into a kind of general physical manifold. Russell is supremely confident in the details of relativity and all sorts of he even knows about quantum theory very early too. Like I think he must have read the original papers in 1925, 1927. And he's already trying to build a kind of unified manifold for physics and psychology based on the notion of the event particular. So, kudos to Russell for having the sophistication, the ability to articulate this philosophical view and try to bring it the rest of the way towards a real unified view of events in physics and events in brains, events in minds.
And that is a fascinating topic. And unfortunately, we are out of time. I wanted to talk a bit more about event particulars and then also at the end where you talk about your what you call enhanced physicalism, which is your contemporary interpretation. You're pushing the neutral monist view a bit forward. I guess if you can say something maybe briefly about that for a minute, minute or two, and then I think we'll have to wrap it up.
Okay, I can't, obviously. what I will say is if you're still listening, if you're sort of on this train, then the last two chapters of the book are an attempt to articulate realistic empiricism as the contemporary view in the metaphysics of mind that is not an epiphenomenalist view or a panpsychist view, and which differs from other neutral monist views in the philosophy of mind, and I think has a lot more in common with the classic views of Mach, James, and Russell, not in the sense that I just sort of slavishly follow them. I mean, I do make changes, and I try to logically articulate a lot of the assumptions and make some of my own arguments in there, mm-hmm. But I think my view is more like the direct descendant of the historical ancestor than a lot of the views that are out there today, which do seem to me very phenomenalistic and very panpsychist by comparison. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave. That's the chapter on philosophy of mind, and the chapter on the last chapter is kind of an attempt to be a contemporary Russellian and do something with these event particulars, with the added device of Grassmann algebra, which is some mathematics that I've kind of happened upon, which seems very uncannily appropriate to articulating some of the features of my view in mathematical terms. So beyond the sort of bare and austere element and function ontology of especially of Mach, I'm trying to add in chapter six some meat on the bones by taking articulating the view within mathematics. Mm-hmm. So I'll have to leave that there.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it sounds like you have a couple of projects, perhaps, already working on next. Are you developing either of the last two chapters, or are you just turning your attention to something else at this point?
Well, yeah. Thank you for asking. I'm fortunate enough to be on a research leave this year, and I've been the chapter six I'm developing into a more articulated project called Extension Theory, which will be a further articulation of the Grassmann algebra and the problem of extension. I mean, how do you construct extended mm-hmm. physics fields and objects from event particulars and their causal functional relations? So that's something I look forward to working harder on.
Great. So, well, we are out of time, but I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with you.
Me too.
Good luck with the book on or whatever comes out with extension theory.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Banks, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Wright State University. We've been talking about his new book, The Realistic Empiricism of Mach, James, and Russell, Neutral Monism Reconceived, which is just out from Cambridge University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.